Well, good afternoon. Greet you in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, who graced a home with his presence as a son to an earthly father and an earthly mother. And he maintained a relationship with his earthly father and mother so closely that when he was hanging on the cross, his heart was still toward his mother. And in that pain and agony, he looked to his mother and wanted to make arrangements for her to be cared for after he was gone. Since 1870, a brick lighthouse painted with a striking black and white spiral pattern has stood tall and immovable on the shore of North Carolina's Outer Banks. Over time, the relentless tide and the eroding shoreline has threatened the very foundation of the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. And finally, in the late 90s, things got serious enough that the engineers faced a hard choice. They could either let the lighthouse crumble into the sea, or they could take some type of bold measure to preserve it. In 1999, they took that bold step. The entire 210-foot lighthouse was jacked off its old foundation by house movers and slowly moved a half mile inland to firmer ground. It was a massive project, it was a costly project, but it saved the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse. And so today the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse still shines as an iconic beacon because somebody was willing to act before the storm claimed it. And in much the same way, our Christian families find ourselves standing on some very rapidly shifting sand. We live in the digital age. It's an age marked by constant noise, addictive screens, and values that flood into our homes and often erode rather than edify. And they threaten to undermine the foundation of our homes. And if we do nothing, the integrity of our families will be undermined. And so the challenge is for us, like the engineers that saved the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse, is to take intentional steps to safeguard what God has entrusted to us and to move our families onto solid ground with Christ as the cornerstone. So that just as the lighthouse continues to shine because it was secured, our families can remain a light in this world because we have strengthened their foundations in Him. The title of the message this afternoon is Coherent Families in a Digital Age. And the burden of the message is to renew our understanding of God's plan for the family so that we can fortify our families against the onslaught of the enemy through digital media. And yes, I believe that we personally and collectively need to move to some safer ground on some of these issues. The word coherent simply means having the quality of holding together or cohering. And so synonyms are words like cohesive or coordinated. And my mind went to science. Cohesion is the natural force of attraction between atoms or molecules of the same type. This stand holds together because there is a cohesive force, a cohesion between the atoms that make it up. Each atom is small and fragile by itself, but when they are bound together by those strong, invisible forces of cohesion, they form things that are very solid. They form the matter that we touch, they form the air that we breathe, they form our very bodies. And so cohesion, the force that is holding them together, is what provides the strength and the stability and the identity of the atoms. And I thought of that in relation to the Christian family because we don't find our coherence solely in a physical closeness. We aren't held together as families because we live in the same house. We are held together by the unseen bonds of faith and love and obedience in Christ. And it's those ties, that cohesion between us as family members, between parents and children and siblings, that enables the family to work together to function as a living organism, not just exist together in a close proximity. But just as in the atoms, in the material of the world, can lose their stability if they're acted on by an outside force, families can lose their coherence when the forces of the modern world are allowed to dominate. If I heated this cup of water to the point where the atoms were so excited that they could no longer stay together through cohesion, they would become steam and disperse. And in a similar way, our families, when there's a phone in every hand and there's schedules packed to the brim and information is pouring into our homes, we can get so busy and so agitated that we lose our cohesion. And the unity that God intended for our families is fragmented. And the family table grows silent. And the living room is full, but it's empty. And the bonds of love and faith are strained because there are louder and faster and more exciting distractions outside. And as I studied this, I came more and more to the conclusion that the root issue of family cohesion is more serious than just spending time together as a family and functioning as a family. There are deeper ramifications to our family coherence. And so for the first part of the message, I'd like to look briefly at God's plan for family coherence. And I invite you again to Deuteronomy. I read some of these verses this morning, and I'm not going to read the entire context for the sake of time, but I'd like to reread a few verses and look at several observations that I believe help us to get a glimpse of this is more than just making sure that my children and I are still on speaking terms when I'm ready to pass from this life, or we can have peaceable family gatherings, or my children are all members of the same church that I'm part of. It goes deeper than that. Deuteronomy 4, verses 9 and 10, and again, I read them this morning. Only take heed to thyself and keep thy soul diligently, lest thou forget the things which thine eyes have seen, and lest they depart from thy heart all the days of thy life. But teach them thy sons and thy sons' sons, especially the day that thou stoodest before the Lord thy God in Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, Gather me the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. A couple pages over to Deuteronomy 6. Again, very familiar verses. We read them this morning in relation to instruction. And these words which I command thee this day, Deuteronomy 6:6, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and thou shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. A few observations on God's plan for family coherence. First, God intends us to keep his commandments. We see this clearly in verse 6 of chapter 4, when he said, Keep therefore and do them. Verse 1 of chapter 6 says, Here are the commandments and the statutes and the judgments that God commanded you to learn so that you would do them. And so obedience is a prime indicator of our faith. There will be just as much obedience to God in the church and in the world as there is in individual lives. Our religion is not just a mere matter of taste or personal preference or philosophy or sentiment. It is based and must be based on obedience to the will of our Supreme Lord and Master. Second observation is that God expects heart devotion to his statutes. Notice verse 9 of chapter 4. They shouldn't depart from your heart. Don't forget them. Chapter 6. Verse 6 says, They shall be in thine heart. And so God is not satisfied with haphazard surface obedience. True heart love for God manifests itself in diligent keeping of his commandments. You know, anyone can hang a scripture motto on a wall, but the true fruit can't be hung on an empty life. It must grow from the root. And it also indicates that this is not going to happen by default. It's going to happen by diligent work. And so the commandments of God aren't just to be in our memory. They are to be engraved on our heart so that what comes out of our heart has them stamped on every piece of it. Third observation is that God plans for his law to be handed from each generation to the next through family life. And this is where it starts to tie into coherence. He's specifically talking to the fathers. And he's saying, you are to know it and you are to teach it. And so parents, especially fathers, are responsible to understand God's word and his will and apply it to the inner man and the outer man in a way that mirrors the careful design of God. And parents, especially fathers, are the conservators and the transmitters of God's law. And so if we love God's law, we will be zealous in teaching it to our children. It's said that Alexander the Great was able to build an army that conquered the world by keeping his family units in his army camp. And so that the children that were born to his soldiers were born in the camp and brought up in the camp. And from day one, they cut their teeth, so to speak, on army things. And they were so indoctrinated with the weapons that Alexander's army used that when they grew up, they didn't go looking for some other way of making wealth, or they didn't look for another country. It had been born and bred into them, and they were raised in it. And if we want our children to live godly lives and embrace the cause of Christ, we have to teach them to bear the yoke from little up. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And the fourth observation in God's plan for family coherence is that God warns us to guard against any influence that is contrary to his precepts. Chapter 4, verse 9 specifically says, lest thou forget, take heed. Don't depart, let them depart from thy heart or from thy son's hearts. And so he's literally saying, in my words, take care of yourself and take care of your family. Literally, watch for any ill influence that would weaken or destroy your loyalty to God or your children's loyalty to God in his law. It's interesting. I had this in my notes, not knowing at all what Brother Anthony would have for a children's lesson. Do you know, if you were walking down a road that was littered with traps or landmines, and you knew it, and you knew that at any moment you could be snared or you could be injured or a landmine would leap up out of the ground and spray you with shrapnel, wouldn't that be enough reason to take heed to yourself? You would walk very, very carefully. And think about how many more fearful dangers lurk on our spiritual journeys than our physical journeys. And so it is the parent's responsibility, with the assistance of the church and the school and the Sunday school, to protect not only ourselves but our children. We would never think of letting a bottle of caustic drain cleaner sit on the counter where our three-year-old could pick it up and drink it. We would never intentionally do that. The challenge is, are we as careful about guarding them against the influences that would corrode their minds and hearts? And such influences vary from generation to generation. You know, I didn't get my first cell phone until I was 18 or something. And my wife and I went through our whole dating experience without her having a cell phone. I don't know how you would do that in this day and age, but so the challenges vary from generation to generation. We have to know the time that we live in and observe and pay attention to our generation. Our grandparents and our parents took a stand against the television and the radio because they understood the influence. And I imagine in my mind the scene where the devil called a conference of his demons and he said, there's a corner of God's kingdom where our plan to come into their homes through television and radio isn't working. This corner over here locked us out. What are we going to do about it? And I imagine one of the demons speaking up and saying, I tell you what, let's combine the television and the radio and the telephone and a camera and books and everything else we can think of and put it onto one device and tie it so closely to business that humans will have a hard time deciding when it stops being a tool and becomes a toy. And I think the whole chorus of demons broke out in a ghoulish laugh. Second part of the message, Satan's scheme to ruin family coherence. For everything good that God creates, everything good he commands, Satan creates a distraction or a counterfeit. And Satan knows that a family unit in which parents and children are coherent and they are talking to each other and they are enjoying each other's company is a family in which truth is going to be transmitted from godly parents to godly children. And so he knows that if he can distance the parents and the children and the children from the parents, that he can obstruct that grand design of God for the generational transmission of truth. Deuteronomy tells us that that's God's plan, and Satan is out to destroy that plan. And I want to be clear, I'm still growing in figuring this out, and the sands keep shifting, and we need to keep reacting to it. And so I in no way want to convey that I've got this figured out. I'm in the middle of it the same as you. Part of Satan's scheme to ruin family coherence is eroding family time and connection. We live under the illusion that we are more connected today than ever before. And given the tremendous advances of communication technology, we should be. Used to be when you went on the mission field, you said goodbye to your family for months or years at a time. Now you can communicate with them every day. But in actual practice, many of our connections are long-range fantasy instead of up-close reality. And we shouldn't try to convince ourselves that it doesn't affect us. We need to be honest and face it. The presence of phones is a constant distraction. The mere presence of a cell phone at your supper table diminishes the conversation quality. Research shows that having a device visible actually creates an attention drain because people are unconsciously aware of that phone. If they see it and they know it's there, there's a portion of their mind that is just focused on it. The most meaningful family discussions typically emerge after several minutes or many minutes of uninterrupted interaction. And if you have a device within reach, that rarely happens. The constant pings and buzzes and alerts, you know, it's just a perpetual interruption of family time. And each of those pings and buzzes and alerts triggers a little bit of dopamine to be released in the brain that makes it almost impossible to ignore. And you know, you're trying to concentrate on something and your phone pings. It is almost impossible to discipline yourself not to see what that message was about. And so, if it's pinging and buzzing and dinging when you're trying to have a family conversation, your attention is constantly fragmented. And family members in that situation will miss emotional cues and they will miss important moments in the discussion because they're constantly being pulled away by these digital taps on their shoulder. Have you ever heard of fubbing? What was a new word to me recently? Fubbing is snubbing someone while looking at your phone. It's a practice that's so common that it actually earned its own word in 2012. And so we fub our family members when we're checking notifications during conversations with them. And we're sending a clear message to our family members that what's happening on our device is more important than they are. They may be sitting right across from us, but if we're on our phone, we're saying, what's on my phone is more important than you. And soon you have everyone immersed in their own digital world, and there's a gradually diminishing trust and emotional intimacy. You're together, you're in the same room, and you're miles apart. I actually read of a youth group. It was in a nominal setting, but there was a youth activity, and the youth were sitting in this crowded living room, and there was a young man that was all of a sudden got very excited and was sharing about this amazing young lady that he was texting during the youth meeting. And he made enough fuss about it that it came out that she was sitting at the opposite end of the sofa. Here they were in the same room communicating digitally and didn't even know that they were in the same room. We've gotten so used to app-based communication that we will literally text someone upstairs in the same house. And there's a time and a place for that. I'm not a prude when it comes to this, but think about what you lose when you eliminate face-to-face interactions. The face-to-face is always more meaningful, and the more we go to digital communication, the more of those small but meaningful interactions we lose. So eroding family time and connection. Another part of Satan's scheme to ruin family coherence is decaying parental roles. Have you ever heard of digital pacifying? That's a term, I don't know that it is an actual term, but it's what I call it. Digital pacifying is using devices to occupy your children while you run errands or go on a car ride or wait for your food at a restaurant. And yes, it may keep the children occupied, but it erodes valuable conversation opportunities. We had a puppy customer come, and while the parents were looking at the puppy, the little boy started fussing, and so the first impulse is to pull out a phone and let him play these crazy music videos over and over and over and over and over and over until he left. Our family could about sing the things from memory, but it got him out of his parents' hair. Those mundane moments when we're tempted to get the children on to something so that they're out of our hair are actually the perfect openings for family interaction. The car ride is a perfect opportunity for a casual chat that leads to strengthening our family bonds. It's the perfect opportunity for children to develop patience and observation skills. They're not missing everything that's going by them outside the car when they're glued to their device. Social abilities are often lost when devices become their default entertainment solution. If you look at the word amuse, we think it means ha-ha. The root of amuse is muse, which means think. The prefix a means not. So to amuse means to cause to not think. It's a lot like a pacifier. You can put a pacifier in a child's mouth and it gives his mouth something to do, but doesn't nourish him. You can hand a child a device to amuse him and gives his brain something to do, but it does not nourish or train it. Parents miss opportunities to teach and to correct and to train when they use digital pacifiers. There's also the blurring of the work and home boundary, and this is a challenge for anyone who works from home at least part of the time, to be able to shut off work and be home. Your family waited for you all day to be at home. Are you home? And so if you're perpetually available for work emails, what you're actually saying is, my work's more important than my family. And you're actually physically present while you can be mentally still at work. And children learn that competing with your work emails is a losing battle. There's also can be through parental roles, there can also be a clandestine undermining of parental authority. It used to be that if parents did something the youth didn't approve of, the youth had to wait until the next service or the next day at school or the next family gathering to complain to their friends about it. Now if mom and dad do something that the child doesn't like, he can complain about it instantly. And he can create a culture of banding together with his friends to encourage whatever disrespect or rebellion he's feeling and create a support group in the heat of the moment. And besides that, he has access to all the anti-authority winds of society. Another piece of Satan's scheme to ruin family coherence is the wearing influence of external voices. We have unparalleled access. If we have unfiltered and unrestricted digital communication, we have unparalleled access to corrupt and horrifyingly wrong things. And we all intend to guard against it. I don't question anyone's sincerity. But even small and subtle exposure that cannot be totally filtered out can wear down our defenses and guards. And after a while, you realize that sin is no longer as exceeding sinful as what it once was to you. And then think about what it's doing to your children. There's unlimited voices of every shade of opinion and degree of Christianity. I think one of the primary Trojan horses that is facing our conservative circles is podcasts. We can listen to anything. And it assaults us on various fronts. One of the biggest ones that I think for adults is that it breaks down our belief in the two kingdom law of Christ. If we listen to mainstream Protestants, we will start to sound like mainstream Protestants and we will start to believe like mainstream Protestants. or Catholics, or any shade of Christians, and as right as some of their philosophies may be, they do not go to the entire gospel. And if we feed on their partial gospel and we embrace their partial gospel, how long will it be until we follow them into the world? And so I have been shocked that it seems as though Charlie Kirk was a bigger hero to many conservative Mennonites than their own faithful fathers and grandfathers. This leads to confusion and disillusionment. Podcasts are loaded with ex-Mennonites that air their grievances and spew venom and seek validation for their points of view and seek out people who are like-minded to them. And I am certainly not here to say that the Mennonite church is perfect. But I am here to say that no matter what your pet peeve or what your hobby horse or what your root of bitterness, you can find online support for it. In fact, you might even find and be able to build up a fan club for it. And you might even be able to monetize it. It opens us to health practices that hybridize science with the occult. It opens us to conspiracy theories that at best are a waste of time. And at worst, well, you fill in the blanks. Another part of Satan's plan to destroy family coherence is the addicting poisons to our health. And there are several levels of this. There's physical health. Psychologists say children need less screen time and more outdoor playtime for mental development. And so modern couch potatoes today aren't just parked in front of the television. They can be anywhere and parked in front of their screens. There's bedtime scrolling, and not only is that a missed opportunity for connections between parents and children and between marriage partners, but the blue light that you just subjected your eyes to for a half hour before you finally turned your phone off is proven to disrupt sleep patterns, reduce sleep quality, and make people irritable. There's emotional health. Digital escapism is a term given to a known phenomenon of avoiding conflict and relationship difficulties. So there's some tension in the home, everybody gets on their phones and just blocks it out. They are escaping reality into a digital world. And yes, it may diffuse the tension, but it's an unhealthy way to resolve conflicts, and it can make resentment simmer under the surface. Children that are used to swiping have less self-control. It's a proven fact. Then there's the whole issue of peer pressure from social media. Anyone who sees social media, catches a little glimpse of social media, very quickly learns that social media is built on stirring up dissatisfaction and a feeling of worthlessness, because when you go on a constant quest for likes and validation rather than authentic interactions and relationships, you don't have real relationships. It's all of these relationships that you're building with people that you don't know. And the feeds of many social media platforms constantly expose the user to edited and filtered content that affects how family members perceive normal relationships. The house is always perfect. The children are always smiling. The dishes are always washed. Everything is always landscaped beautifully. The vacation is always works out perfectly. And so it comes to a point where the normal, messy, imperfect, but perfectly authentic family life is disappointing, because we're comparing it against these curated versions that we see online. And so we live in an altered reality. The reality of family vacation, it's like somebody said, Winston Churchill said, we shall fight them on the beaches, we shall fight them in the streets. He said, that sounds like our family vacation. We live in an altered reality, and AI isn't doing anything to help it. There are AI-powered grief bots. They are chatbots that mimic deceased loved ones. And so they're created by training the AI by feeding them emails and recordings and diaries and writings of your departed loved one so that it can actually generate responses that sound like the person that you've lost. And so families interact with a digital version of their deceased relative, sometimes even mimicking their actual voices and conjuring up memories that actually happen. And experts, you don't have to be an expert to think through this, but experts say what actually happens is that you never grieve healthily. It replaces healthy grieving. And so it complicates emotional closure, and it risks actually masking the reality of loss and the reality of death, which is so important to help people process death and find healing. And of course, if you spent much time in the tech world, you realize that there are an increasing number of cases in which AI bots have counseled teens on how to hide their despair from their family and coached them to commit suicide. Another tactic of Satan in ruining family coherence is destroying generational fidelity. And he does this because every generation has different understanding of and different attitudes toward tech. And he uses that as a wedge issue. But circling back to the beginning, he knows that if he can distance the parents from the children and the children from the parents, he can hamper God's design for generational transmission of truth. He wants to work against Malachi 4:6, where it says John the Baptist will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children toward the fathers, and Satan is out to destroy that. Instead of the ideal situation where parents are fully engaged in the serious work of embedding God's truth into their children, and children are responding with loving respect and obedience. It's that time of the afternoon. Let's all stand and sing, or those who can, let's stand and sing a verse of Ode to Be Like Thee.
Oh, to be like thee, blessed Redeemer, this is my constant.
Last part of the message, nurturing connection in the digital age. And I want to be clear. Some people use technology as a hate word. Everything is technology, technology. Technology itself is not inherently evil. You want to trade your automotive technology for the automotive technology of 100 years ago, be my guest. Technology itself is not inherently evil, but its habits, the habits and the uses of it create these issues of good versus evil and of wise versus unwise, and they call us to clear boundaries. So how do we nurture connection in a digital age? First, honestly evaluate and renew your family vision. Is your foundation sure? Is my foundation sure? Are the teachings of Christ, the clear teachings of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, the cornerstone of our home? Faith, love, truth, purity. Are we depending on God for wisdom in building our homes? Off the English coast in the English Channel is a lighthouse called the Eddystone Lighthouse. It was placed there over 250 years ago to warn ships of some dangerous reefs. And the architect that built it was so confident that he was building a strong lighthouse that he had engraved in the cornerstone this: "Blow, O ye winds, rise, O ocean waves, break forth, ye elements, and try my work." What a foolish taunt. And less than 3 years later, as that architect and his crew of men were working at the lighthouse doing some repairs, a violent storm swept the lighthouse and the architect and his crew off of that foundation and destroyed them all. In 1756, they decided to rebuild the lighthouse, and this time, the architect was much wiser. He found a new site, and he dug down to the solid rock. And this time on the cornerstone, he had engraved the verse, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." The lighthouse is still standing today and was still in use as of the source that I read. Other foundation can no man lay than it is laid, and that is Jesus Christ. But a broad scope of Protestants and Catholics and Christianity in general would agree with that statement. Jesus Christ is the cornerstone. And so are we also convinced that having been handed the truth and knowing that cornerstone, we can't compromise as we build on the foundation, and we dare not soften our biblical applications and our practical obedience? Commitment is indispensable. The see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil approach will not work. And I challenge myself as much as I challenge anyone when I ask myself the question, is the reason that I sometimes have trouble drawing lines for my family's use of digital technology because I'm too enamored with my own tech toys? We need to play the man. Be strong. We are not here to play, to dream, to drift. We have hard work to do and loads to lift. Shun not the struggle. Face it. 'Tis God's gift. Be strong. Say not the days are evil. Who's to blame? And fold the hands and acquiesce. Oh, shame. Stand up, speak out, and bravely in God's name. Be strong. It matters not how deep entrenched the wrong, how hard the battle goes, the day how long. Faint not, fight on. Tomorrow comes the song. So we honestly evaluate and renew our family vision. Secondly, we model the hard but healthy choices. Children should know, our children should know, my children should know that I value holiness of mind and life above any money, any pleasure, and any convenience. And they should be able to tell that by the decisions and the choices I make in tech usage. A holy life will make the deepest impression. A lighthouse doesn't have to sound any horns. It just shines. Our children should also know that we value them and the family above any money, any pleasure, or any convenience, because they see us laying our phones aside and fully engaging with them. Our children will largely pattern their tech usage after ours. So we model the hard but healthy choices. Thirdly, we should establish tech-free zones and times. And I give this next point cautiously because I know that there's no set age and no set number that works for all families and even all children. But I believe that childhood and adolescence should largely be a tech-free time. It's been proven by physicians and psychologists that it's healthy for brain development. But beyond that, it's healthy for emotional development and spiritual development. And so there are several principles that I think we need to evaluate as we decide when our children have access to phones and how much they have access to them. And the first principle is simply the need. If a phone is a tool and not a toy or a novelty, then there's really no need to have a phone until the child's working away from home or driving and needs to be in communication. I say this carefully, but there are very few school-age children who really need their own phone. If you evaluate it simply on the fact of need. And I would encourage us to wait as long as possible and as long as practical for mental development, if nothing else. The second thing to evaluate is the maturity. How responsible is this child? Are they impulsive and carnal and selfish and rebellious? Now, they're not going to be ready to discipline themselves and avoid and turn away from objectionable material and honor the time limits and refrain from foolishness in their communication. Do they know how to delay gratification, or are they always on to the next thing that makes them feel good? Their spiritual life comes in here. We have some friends who had a son who was 18 and had not yet given his heart to the Lord. He had his own phone, but they said, "No, you're not having Spotify because you don't have the Holy Spirit to help you use it. No Holy Spirit. No Spotify." And the third principle is supervision. A young driver doesn't get one day, get the keys handed to them, and they're off on their own. A young driver apprentices with a parent, and they prove their ability to drive, and they subject themselves to restrictions on when they can and what they can do behind the wheel, and they gradually earn the right to full privileges. And I would suggest that we consider a similar pattern for digital technology. Some families start with a family phone that's available for use by permission. It has limited functions. You can teach by the way as they have a phone and as they use it and as they get more privileges. Start with parental controls and time limits on it that you control. Shared accounts, shared passwords, rules about downloads, accountability. They should know that mom and dad can see what they're doing and can check in at any time. There should never be a case where a young teen has a phone that mom and dad can't get into. And I personally believe that fathers, as long as our children are under normal marriageable age and are still reporting to us as the primary male authority in their life, we're responsible to monitor and guide their technology use. There's not one of us here that would turn a 16-year-old loose with a Ferrari. And we wouldn't do that because the Ferrari has power way beyond what he needs. And it has an ego boost far in excess of what he can handle. And if he's under 16, he doesn't need a Ferrari anyway. But even when he's over 16, he doesn't need that flash and he doesn't need that power. He needs utility. And I would suggest that we think about that in relation to digital technology. Think about the power of the device that you're handing over. This is not just a communication device. It's not a tin can telephone that has one use. It's a powerful, always-on computer that has potentially unlimited access to the digital world with all its temptations and distractions. So, childhood and adolescence should be a tech-free time. Secondly, we should disconnect from our phones. Light the lamp of warmth and protection and hope that we find in the family circle, where true belonging and true love are possible. I believe there should be certain times when phones are prohibited in our family life. They go on airplane mode, or they go on the dock or the charger. I believe one of those places should be the bedroom for youth. I would rather spend the money for an alarm clock and keep the phone out of the bedroom. I would suggest, and we try to practice no phones at mealtime. And there can be some initial resistance, but over time you will find that not having your phones at mealtime deepens conversations and bonds. It's a simple discipline that we can use to foster a real connection. And use that opportunity when we're gathered around the table to engage in meaningful conversations and share stories from the day and truly connect with each other. If you go to a restaurant to eat, you can tell which families enjoy being with each other. The ones that enjoy being with each other are talking to each other and looking at each other in the eye. The ones who don't enjoy being with each other are all on their phones. I was really impressed one night. I took one of my daughters out for a little date supper, and I looked over and here's an older couple with a handicapped child, and it looked like they were having a very nice meal, communicating with each other, until I realized that the man had his phone set down behind his water glass, and he was watching a baseball game while it looked like he was looking at his family. I believe we should plan quality family time, structure our schedules to spend time together, plan regular activities that encourage old-fashioned bonding and communication, have a family night and play board games and laugh and make memories together. Connect over nature. It'll lift your collective spirits to the Lord to go on an outdoor outing to a park and have a picnic, or go hiking or visit local attractions. I saw a spoof of the food pyramid, you know, the food pyramid where you have the grain and then the fruit and vegetables and then the meat and the dairy and the fats and the sweets, very limited amounts of fats and sweets, mostly grains. And someone suggested that we should have a tech pyramid or a wisdom pyramid, where most of our wisdom comes from the Bible and from the local church and from nature and from books and a little bit from tech. Lastly, accountability and dialogue. Parents, we have to know what our youth are doing on their phones. And it's not a lack of trust. It is responsibility. I read the account of a juvenile delinquent who was in trouble with the law. And a counselor was working with him, and he called the boy and his father in and talked to them. And over in the course of the conversation, the father assured the son, "I love you. I want the best for you. I love you, son." And the boy would not open up. Finally, the counselor sent the father out of the room, and he continued to reason with the son. "Your father loves you. Your family loves you." And finally, the boy erupted. And he burst out, "If he really loved me, he wouldn't have left me stay out till 2 o'clock. We need to teach digital discernment. Learn for ourselves, continue to learn for ourselves, and teach our children to filter the influences that they receive and we receive through the Word. And remember, curiosity kills cats. It corrupts humans. And I believe we have to have an open and honest communication on the effect that tech is having and hear each other's thoughts on the best boundaries to establish. Mom and Dad, we have to have our eyes wide open, and we have to pay realistic attention to our children's use of technology and our own, and be honest about it. 11 miles off the east coast of Scotland in the North Sea, there's a lighthouse called the Bell Rock Lighthouse, and it has withstood the North Sea's violent storms since 1811. It's built on less than an acre of solid rock. And the interesting thing about that acre of solid rock is that it is covered for 20 hours out of the day by seawater. And so the builder of the lighthouse, Robert Stevenson, and his 65 artisans had 4 hours each day in which they could build the foundation for the lighthouse. They would rush in, and for 4 hours they would chink away at the solid rock and gouge a foundation from it. But they stuck at it, and as a result of that painstaking, patient work, that 115-foot lighthouse is still in use today. Parents, we have a very short window of time in which to lay a foundation for our children and to anchor our children to withstand the storms of life. Let's take advantage of that window and patiently and consistently carve out a foundation for them on the solid rock. Let's pray.